This is Economics for Entrepreneurs, the podcast where we apply the principles of economics to help you make the best decisions for your life and business. Here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We're exploring entrepreneurship as the best option for every one of us to create our own individual economy and to ensure that we feel economically enfranchised through our own initiatives. Entrepreneurship is the answer to your question about what kind of a life you can have if you want to take control rather than cede control. We've conducted significant research into the attributes an entrepreneur brings to the control task. Just to list them here, they are empathy, the number one trait that we'll be talking about a lot, rigid determination, adaptability, grit, interconnectedness, lifelong learning, low time preference, and a combination of individualism with co-creation, the ability to collaborate with customers in the creation of new value. You can learn more about these attributes at hunterhastings.com. We all bring those attributes in various combinations. So each of us is going to be a different kind of entrepreneur. We're going to choose different businesses and different styles of operating them. Today, we'll explore some of those business types and style options. We are talking to Ricky Porco. He's an entrepreneur who operates Strive Local, a business services provider focused on helping small businesses to meet their business goals, especially in marketing and effective digital presence. He's been an entrepreneur all his professional life, a co-founder of an innovative community building platform, a marketing, sales, and rainmaker at a digital marketing agency, and a co-founder of a software development company. He's an entrepreneur who supports entrepreneurs. Ricky, hello.
Hey, Hunter. Thanks for having me today.
Let's start with what kind of an entrepreneur you are. Tell us about Strive Local and where you would place yourself and your business in a typology of entrepreneurship.
Sure thing. So Strive Local started when I needed a legal entity to encompass a large portfolio of work that I had accumulated, mostly as a freelancer building websites and running digital ad campaigns for local businesses. When I started, I was still working full-time at a medium-sized marketing agency. And I was trying to acquire my own freelance contracts on the side, sort of on nights and weekends. Now the business has evolved into something a little different. It's a group of talented individuals with unique and specialized skills that I can call on to complete specific parts of projects. So we're a pretty interesting organizational model because it's very flexible. Everyone that I work with has other jobs or their own freelance gigs. So they're not employees of Strive Local. It allows me to add trusted pieces to the team sort of only when we need them. So that way we can offer a range of services. Our services include photography and video production all the way up to custom app development. And we can offer those services without having to have a huge full-time staff, which ends up being a win-win for me and for our clients. We work from home, sometimes in different parts of the country. So it can be very dispersed, and we rely a lot on technology to help us communicate and collaborate like we're in the same room. I travel to clients when needed or to meet in person, but a lot of the work is done remotely. It's nice because we don't have a ton of overhead. We're not an agency like you'd see in the Mad Men era with a ton of employees and a massive office filled with expensive furniture. We're very flexible. We're very focused. And we're able to deliver very high quality services at a fraction of the hourly rate that some of our larger competitors are charging.
Well, that sounds very innovative. You've got a set of specialized skills that meet the needs of customers, a very flexible organizational design that lets you bring resources together in a very efficient manner, and that's reflected in low cost to the customer. And your customer is a very specific target audience, it sounds like. Is that a good description of your strategic setup?
Yeah, absolutely. We've tried to become sort of specialized, like you said, to the local small business. I've found that they have a very specific set of requirements. And over the course of the past 5, 6, 7 years, an interesting trend that I've seen that sort of pushed me into serving local small businesses is there are quite a few of them that are transitioning from what I would call a pen and paper organization to a digital organization. And that's a really interesting transition to be a part of. And so I've seen businesses at that level transition well, and I've seen them sort of get held up in not understanding with the array of tools out there and the ways to get organized digitally, how to do those things. And so that's been the particular niche that we've tried to serve, and the offering that we've tried to create is one that really helps those local small businesses transition from sort of the old way of doing things to the new way of doing things.
I think that's a great insight, Ricky. As someone who has studied economics for entrepreneurs, I'm a big believer in getting the target audience right. That's a good basis for having a successful business. And to get it right, you've got to define it in the proper way. And you've defined it not just demographically as a small business, the way the government does based on number of employees or amount of revenue, but situationally as small business in transition from paper to digital. Would you say that you carefully selected that niche, or did it come to you as you did other things and began to realize that there was an opportunity out there?
So it actually came to me sort of in the earlier stages of my career. I'd started a business with some friends in college. It was a local social networking platform called Commonplace. And what we were trying to do with Commonplace was really sort of digitize the local information sphere. So a hybrid of a Craigslist and a Facebook type network that would help you get what you needed locally and sort of retain some of that local social capital that you lose in the larger networks like Facebook. And throughout the course of that process, one of the ways that we tried to reach individuals in small towns was through small businesses. We knew at the time that small businesses, municipal organizations, they tended to be gatekeepers for a lot of people. They had large followings. And so we wanted to reach those people. And in doing so, we tried to partner with those local businesses and bring them online and sort of show them the platform and the ways that they could benefit from having a local, you know, digital information sphere. And throughout that process, I was time and time again sort of bombarded with questions about digital marketing and how to get online and how to get a website. So in the late 2000s, 2008, 2009, when a lot of those small businesses were really just experiencing getting their first website, getting on Facebook for the first time, sort of understanding what this new digital space was going to be. I was a young college guy there talking to them about technology, and they had a lot of questions about how to get their businesses online. And so after Commonplace ended and that experiment that we'll get into talking about in a little bit, I'm sure, that experiment sort of ended, I was left with this wealth of information that I had about what local small businesses were struggling with. And I also had a pretty decent skill set in as far as you know, helping them reach those goals.
It's a great lesson. In the textbooks, they talk about discovering customers' needs, and you've brought it to life. What you're talking about is you work with them, you understand what their problems are, you just learn as you go along, you observe what they're struggling with. And being part of that whole process is how you bring the idea of discovering needs to life. One thing you mentioned in that process was that you started pretty young. You've been an entrepreneur since your college days. What's the impact of that, do you think, on your experience over time and your ability over time to serve customers better? Has it been an advantage to be in the entrepreneurial channel for so long?
I think it's been an advantage. It's changed, I think, the way that I've looked at a couple of different things. I think failure being one of them. I sort of mentioned in the last little bit the commonplace experiment coming to an end, which there is, you know, a fancy way of saying that we did fail with that startup. We had some funding and we had some trajectory as one of the first local place-based networks to get online. And the process of failing with Commonplace, it was a true learning experience. I got a ton out of it. Like I mentioned, it sort of pushed me on this new career path. But most of all, it gave me the desire to create value, to take it into my own hands, I guess would be the best way of saying it. As a college student at 18 and 19 years old, I'd seen a lot of my peers sort of prepping their resumes, doing everything that they could to sort of stand out, moving on to the next stage and get that job that they thought was, you know, exactly what they wanted. And some of them got it and some of them didn't. But what I valued most out of that experience was trying to create something for myself and in turn, you know, create something for others that a ton of people were using and getting value from. So it gave me an interesting perspective on failing and what is failing and understanding how to, you know, derive some value even out of a situation like Commonplace that didn't work, but it gave me a lot of information that I needed to take the next step in my career.
Right. The people who write about entrepreneurship like to talk about failing as a learning experience, but that can feel pretty painful at the time you're going through that experience. But the point you're making, I think, is that you build up that learning inventory over time.
There was a sting when you know, we sort of ran out of money there down the line. But again, it gave me the skill set that I needed and the information that I needed to take the next step in my career.
Well, let's look at that next step that you took through this lens of the different types and styles of entrepreneurship that you've seen, both in yourself and your partners and in your customers. You've talked about Commonplace, which was a group of co-founders and a venture capital funded startup. And those are driven by milestones and by hitting targets. You've been at Civic Tech Lab and Estlin Design, which are different choices in entrepreneurial style, fast growth, but different kinds of organization, different scales. So talk about organization and leadership and styles of some of the different entrepreneurial types that you've come across.
Sure. So I've had some interesting experiences in that the last few positions that I've been at were sort of different and the same in that I had entrepreneurial opportunity at all of them. But one of them, I was an employee. I was sort of midway through in terms of the hierarchy. I had a lot of opportunities at Estlin Design to go out and create new revenue. But ultimately, I had a boss and someone that I reported to. So it was an interesting feeling after being so young in college when we started Commonplace and sort of having that unlimited entrepreneurial freedom to create the path forward, rather than sort of fall in line, if you will, and take the path forward. And so that was interesting for me personally, but just to look at the different types of companies at different entrepreneurial stages. Commonplace was very early seed stage and funded. Everything was tied to milestones, and inevitably sort of missing milestones and running out of runway there ended up killing us. Estlin Design was the job that I immediately took after Commonplace disintegrated. And that was an interesting opportunity for me personally because I sort of got to go to work as an employee for the first time rather than a co-founder. And so that was an interesting step to take. Estlin was a local small business that had reached its peak at the local and maybe even regional level as far as the businesses that it could serve and the capacity that it could grow to. We'd grown to about 10 people And we were sort of having some trouble reaching that next stage of growth beyond our region, maybe looking nationally to some larger clients. And then Strive Local, like I mentioned before, it's another interesting experience where, again, I've sort of found myself at the helm of an organization that looks something like Esalen Design, but with my own spin to it. It's been a very unique experience growing Strive Local by myself. I had partners when we started Commonplace, and I, of course, had a much larger team around me when I worked at Esalen Design. So building Strive Local from the ground up without a partner has also been an interesting experience. And as far as what type of business it's allowed me to create, it's been one that I've sort of gotten to mold along the way to make sure that it fits the lifestyle both at work and outside of work that I'm trying to achieve for myself.
It's clearly one of the benefits of entrepreneurship. We said at the beginning that it's a way to take control. Obviously, there are long hours and hard work and weekends, but also there's a way to mold your personal and family life together with your business life, which is far more flexible than it is when you're working for a corporation.
I think that was one of my main goals in creating this business and in choosing to leave the quote-unquote corporate world at my last job. And again, just like in leaving Commonplace, there were a number of lessons to take from my experience at Esalen. I think one of the main takeaways that I had from working at Esalen was that we could really trim overhead. At a digital agency, when so much of our tools, resources, and assets were digital, and so much of our work is based on the computers and sort of can be done anywhere, I felt that there was a tremendous opportunity present to really cut overhead and sort of just use myself as a hub for making sure all of the services could get done, sort of like the general contractor of digital presences.
As you look at all of the businesses that you've participated in, Ricky, and those you serve through Strive Local, let's see if we can start to draw some broadly applicable conclusions. I'll seed the discussion here. I run a seed stage venture capital fund, and there's a couple of lessons that we see consistently. One is about growth. And you mentioned that the individuals who start the business on its growth path are not always the ones that can take it to the next stage. A good entrepreneur has to recognize that. Often a tech-centric beginning, building some kind of platform or technology, needs to transition into a sales and marketing organization to bring in customers and do all of the things that gets loyalty and cash flow growth and so on. Sometimes you've got to make a decision to change leaders. Sometimes you need different leaders for different phases. A second one, and you hinted at it, is don't run out of money, which sounds simplistic, but actually it's got huge lessons about frugality and resource allocation, spending just enough on just the right things to get to your milestones, nothing more, nothing less, understanding that it always takes longer to get the technology right or to raise funds than entrepreneurs anticipate. You need more runway sometimes than you would expect. And you can't run into a brick wall, or you can get into a very difficult negotiation about the next round of funding because you're dealing from a position of weakness. I call those fundamental lessons. The leader who starts the growth phase doesn't necessarily have to be the one to continue it. And the first rule of entrepreneurship, don't run out of money. I'm sure you have some others. What are some of the other fundamental lessons that you've seen, either from your own experiences or from those of your clients?
I think one of the most important lessons that I learned in my early entrepreneurial career at Commonplace is understanding whether or not you are good at financial planning. And I think that that can be a really important lesson that a lot of entrepreneurs learn the hard way. Having a good idea, being great at marketing, being an excellent service provider, being at the top of your game as far as having a skill doesn't necessarily mean that that skill translates well to financial management. And I think particularly as college students who didn't have a ton of experience in sort of even managing our own finances, that was a tough thing to learn the hard way, was that maybe we had a great idea and we were even executing pretty well, but we weren't that good at managing money. And so that was an important lesson for us to learn and a huge takeaway from that experience. From Esalen, another experience that I had seen sort of time and time again with businesses of all sizes that we've served as our clients was a bit of a disconnect from management understanding that marketing has to happen. And so perhaps a self-serving message from the guy who's selling marketing services. But we ran into executives and sort of upper management that didn't make way or didn't make any budget for marketing. So that was another important lesson that I took away from Esalen, was that you can't grow without spending some money, whether that's to reach people or in research and development to make that next breakthrough. Again, it comes down to financial planning and understanding where your strengths and weaknesses are.
It's a great point about financial planning. Would you call that adult supervision? Or did you just need somebody from an MBA class who can use QuickBooks and manage the money?
Yeah, in our particular situation, I think adult supervision is actually the correct way of speaking about it. Again, the oldest one of us at that point was 20. So among three co-founders, 18, 19, and 20, maybe some adult supervision would have helped. With that said, yeah, I think another sort of important lesson to have come from Commonplace and that learning experience was understanding who the founders are and choosing your founding partners and your founding members correctly. And so if, for example, like you say, adult supervision may not be an option, then perhaps, yeah, making sure there's somebody in the mix who's really going to make finances their focus, making sure that you don't run out of money is their sole job. And I think maybe if we had someone in that position, we'd be telling a different story right now.
I fully endorse your point about marketing too. In fact, in my head, economics is marketing. It tells you you've got to find your target audience, your target customer. You've got to understand what they need, which is that skill of empathy. You've got to design the solution to help them solve that problem, meet that need. Then you've got to reach them. You've got to talk to them and persuade them and support them when they become customers. And all of that is marketing. It's absolutely fundamental that marketing is part of the makeup of any entrepreneurial company. It doesn't matter what it's doing.
Yeah, and it's been particularly interesting to see from the local business point of view, because another interesting transition that I've sort of been able to observe is the what I might call the changing of the guard in locally owned, family-owned businesses. The classic father-son business, and dad's maybe thinking about retiring in the next couple of years. And the son's coming in and maybe wanting to change things a little bit, spend a little more on digital advertising. And I've seen a lot of instances where you get a tremendous amount of hesitance to try some of these new things that are making, some of your local competitors successful. And so I've seen a lot of that changing of the guard stress in local family businesses, particularly with regard to marketing spend, which is interesting.
Yeah, and economics recognizes the possibility for what we call entrepreneurial error. And there's no need to fear that error. You've talked about failure or mistakes, but it's not really that. It's impossible to predict the future. And entrepreneurs are people who work in the future, and you can't always get it right. So looking at those kinds of businesses that you started to talk about, if I'm your client base, and without trying to highlight any identifiable businesses, you mentioned a couple of the challenges that they face. The transition from one generation to the next, as you just mentioned, maybe spending too much or too little on digital marketing. Can you generalize a little bit about some of the mistakes or poor decisions that you see being made and how to help those entrepreneurs who are clients of yours to make the right decisions? How are you able to do that?
I think one of the most common issues that I've seen is founders or managers or owners clogging information flow. And I think that that can be an issue with any business, but it should be in this day and age, a one that's particularly easy to solve with the amount of communication tools that are out there. And so when I say clogging information flow, what I mean is sort of, I see a lot of businesses that most of the information flows through one or two people. And that can include information about what to do next, what the larger plan is, everything from the vision of the company to really the day-to-day minutia in terms of what tasks are getting done and the order of those tasks and priority. And so when so much of that is funneled through one person or depends on one person to make sure everybody knows what the next step is, the absence of that person can be incredibly detrimental to the business. And so that can even include, for a lot of these small business clients, taking a sick day can be catastrophic for some of these businesses who so much of the information and communication relies on and flows through one individual.
Yes, and that goes back to the point that you made at the beginning about flexible organizations that are networks rather than hierarchies, so that people can make fast decisions on their own. Information about that decision can go upwards instead of downwards, or sideways instead of downwards from the top. And it can be managed not by a supervisory role, but by an information sharing role, as you've described. I think we see that in a lot of the trends that are happening in the current digital revolution. It's changing organization in that way. And it's very interesting what you say, that a family business, which is the way a lot of entrepreneurial businesses start out, tends to be hierarchical, which is the wrong kind of organization for most entrepreneurs.
Yeah, it certainly does tend to be hierarchical. And so one of the things that we've tried to do in terms of serving those clients' digital needs is anything we can do to, again, help digitize those pen and paper businesses. One of the things in my experience that tends to keep those hierarchies in place, at least for the small businesses that I've dealt with, tends to be that sticking to pen and paper. It really, if we can digitize a lot of the communication, we can open the communication. And so one thing that we've tried to really do is when we build up that trust and have solid relationship with our clients, ask them, you know, what we can help with, what we can digitize and sort of how we can open up that communication so that we can enable more decision-making for everybody in the company. Great example of this, I think, is we've helped a couple of our construction clients, so residential home builders, commercial construction firms. They tend to have a lot of employees, and they also tend to have a lot of turnover, especially if there's particularly seasonal work. And so one of the things that we've tried to do to help those companies cope with employee turnover is by really taking stock of all of the institutional information that they have, everything that makes that company's on-site training unique to them, all of the facets of working with that company. And we try and make sort of onboarding packets, ways that all of that institutional information can be passed down and installed quickly that don't require a managing body or an entity training them constantly. So it's in ways that we digitize, that we open up some of the communication. Those are the ways that I think we've helped these pen and paper businesses transition and really reduce that need for one person or a couple of people to have so much of the functions of the business in their head.
That's a great insight, Ricky. Today, we have the generalized assistance of software, and software is organization. You can run your company on Slack, and there's no hierarchy in Slack. There might be channels, or there might be individuals who are assigned to various tasks, but it's not really a hierarchy, and it's designed for the kind of information sharing you're talking about. You can automate so many parts of your business. And instead of using command and control, you can use monitoring to see what's happening. As you say, knowledge becomes a shared asset that everybody can access whenever they need it. Your mission of helping businesses make this digital transition is going to help them to not only organize, but to grow and to be more effective and to allocate resources well. And they shouldn't be scared of software. They should look at it as the way to organize the business.
Absolutely. And what I've found most often is right now, especially over the course of the last decade, as software as a service has seen such a boom, a lot of the hesitance comes from the complete saturation of tools out there. A lot of my clients maybe have started the process of trying to research Slack or project management tools or some of these things that could open up or digitize communication. And when they go to start that journey of research, they're a little bit overwhelmed. And so that's another way that we've sort of tried to ease that process by using the tools ourselves, understanding the strengths of one tool versus the strengths of another, and which one might be best in which particular situation. And so if you do a couple of Google searches just looking for, you know, project management tools or anything of the like, you'll find quite a bit. And so that's another thing that we try and help with, is thinning the herd and reducing some of the noise in that decision.
Well, it's a great service. Let's see if we can draw any conclusions here, and you might want to make some recommendations. We started out talking about types and styles of entrepreneurship, and we talked about local small businesses and family businesses. We talked about specialization. We've talked about high growth startups based on technology. Maybe some of those are creating new markets, as you've been involved with. We also said that you need to really understand your target audience. You need to listen to them and find out what their needs are. And that you've discovered that in the transitional small business from pen and paper to digital, there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of problems that they have to solve. You talked about the need for a very good financial control system. You talked about the need for leaders to recognize when there's another kind of transition from one phase of growth to another, and perhaps to bring in new talent. We talked about the importance of marketing. So that's a long list, and I have two questions for you. Any advice to add to that? And secondly, think about entrepreneurship for everyone as a concept. Or are there certain types of persons or styles of person that should be taking on the entrepreneurship task and not others?
Some recommendations that I think I would have on both sides of the coin, sort of for would-be entrepreneurs and also for current entrepreneurs looking to reach a next stage, let's say, of their entrepreneurial journey. One, I think for those would-be entrepreneurs, it's super important to open your eyes wider if you haven't found the opportunity that you're looking for yet. It might not be there staring you in the face, but it's probably there somewhere. And in my case, I was certain at the time that Commonplace, the business that we were building, was the opportunity. It was the golden opportunity. It was a shining trophy that was right in front of my face that I just needed to latch onto. What I didn't realize until a few years later was that my opportunity was sort of hidden within all of the knowledge that I was learning from Commonplace and all of the experiences that I was having there with local small businesses that gave me the knowledge of how to pick this group of people to serve. So one recommendation for would-be entrepreneurs would be to open your eyes wider and try to learn from every experience that you have in business, because something is there for you. For those current entrepreneurs and people that are just sort of starting out in their journey, another sort of takeaway that I would pass along is to specialize in something. Specialize what you're offering. And even if you're good at a lot of things, I like to think that we as a company, myself and my team members at Strive Local, are good at a lot of things. But we try and really specialize our offering and the group of people that we're trying to find. And once we build trust and we feel good about the relationship that we have with our client, then maybe we roll out some of these other things that we're good at. But the way that we draw people in
is by sharing expertise and by being very specific about who we are, what we are best at, and who we might serve best. And then for those people who are maybe thinking about entrepreneurship or prepping those resumes and about to graduate college and not sure if they should be thinking about starting something on their own, go and get a job and learn. And you might learn that you're very happy with the job that you have. And you might learn that you're ready to become an entrepreneur. Either way, job experience is incredibly valuable. It was the only thing that gave me confidence to go out on my own again and feel like I could test the market, feel like I could create value on my own. The only thing that gave me that confidence was being successful as an employee at my job. And in doing so with some financial security, with a guaranteed paycheck every week, it took some of that pressure off. It took some of that stress off, and it gave me the flexibility, both with time and mental capacity. It gave me what I needed. It gave me the confidence and the skills that I needed to take the next step personally in my career.
I agree. One definition of entrepreneurship is managing your own future. And it's a perfectly good choice to enter the employment workforce for a while to learn some skills and then go back out and be an entrepreneur again. That's a good lesson for people to draw. Hey, Ricky, we need to wrap up. So thank you very much for today. Where should people go to find Strive Local?
Sure. Thanks again for having me. If you're interested, go ahead to gostrivelocal.com, gostrivelocal.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere that good digital marketers should be.
Ricky, thank you. And that's it, everybody, for today at Economics for Entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week when we'll continue to explore the economic principles that can help you make smarter business decisions and grow your business. Thank you.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.